This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. We're only 5 days into 2022, and it's already apropos to break out the Rolling Stones. The winter is feeling cold and hard. On Monday, a winter storm swiftly dropped a foot of snow and created dangerously icy conditions in Virginia. The weather trapped hundreds of drivers on I-95 as overturned tractor trailers and multi-car accidents blocked the busy interstate on the first workday of the new year. For some, the ordeal went on for more than 24 hours. Yesterday, Mary Louise Kelly of NPR talked with Senator Tim Kaine, whose typical two-hour commute from Richmond stretched on for an agonizing 27 hours.
I left at 1 o'clock Monday to come up for a voting rights meeting that was last night at 8 o'clock, and I felt like, you know, there was snow, but that would give me enough time to get here. But I got bogged down a number of times where the ice and the snow was so bad and the cars were just stopped for 5 or 6 hours at a time. And I just arrived at the office at about 3:45. So it was a miserable experience.
The storm left hundreds stranded on the highway and snatched electricity from another 500,000 from North Carolina through New Jersey, leaving hundreds of thousands of households without heat or light during these long, cold January nights. While the storm battered the mid-Atlantic, the Omicron variant has shattered national complacency about COVID-19. On Monday, the U.S. set a new record, reporting more than 1 million new infections. Infections, illness, hospitalizations, and deaths are affecting communities across the nation and disrupting families, schools, and businesses. And I hope we're gonna be a long, hot summer.
And a lot of love will be burning bright.
And at the end of last week, residents of Boulder, Colorado, experienced a devastating end to 2021 in the form of destructive, fast-burning wildfires.
Within 5 minutes, our neighbors called and said the fire department was coming down, telling everybody to get out. And it wasn't much longer than that that our son called and saw news coverage up the hill, and he could see that there were flames on our roof.
It's unbelievable. It's really just down to rubble in so many places.
Well, we thought 2022 might be better, and then we had Omicron, and now we have this. And it's not starting out very well.
Those are the voices of residents from Superior and Louisville, Colorado, speaking with the Associated Press about the recent fires. Almost 1,000 homes in Boulder County were destroyed. One GoFundMe page tells the story of Corey, John, and Patrick, whose home in the Sagamore neighborhood of Superior, Colorado, was consumed. The young men, described by their lifelong friends as, quote, the most down-to-earth, kind-hearted individuals you could meet, were given only 7 minutes' notice to evacuate. And all three did get out safely, along with their beloved pets, but they lost all of their worldly possessions. And they're not alone. We heard from Annette in Denver, who told us this heartbreaking story of her friends.
Their entire home and their second car was burned to the ground. The father in this family had taken the mother to the hospital for a procedure and was going to wait until it was done and take her home. But the mother suggested he go home, pick up their daughter and their dog, just to be sure. He went back, picked them up, and returned to pick up his wife, and they were never able to go back to their home. When they went back, it was a pile of ash.
Now, wildfires have grown increasingly common in Colorado due to climate change, but according to Colorado Public Radio, last week's fires were among the most serious that have ever taken place away from the state's more heavily forested areas. That's a potentially troubling sign of things to come. And it's sure been a cold, cold winter. And for more, I'm joined now by Mayor Clint Folsom of Superior, Colorado. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Melissa, thanks for having me.
I know it's been a very stressful week for your community. How are you and your family doing?
We're holding up okay. It has been a very tough time for the entire community. Part of my extended family lost some homes in Superior, and it is just heartbreaking when I go around town and I can easily identify homes and who used to live there and who's lost their homes. And it's just really, it is a heartbreaking situation.
Mayor, this sounds so deeply personal. And I guess I'm interested, as you've been talking with residents of Superior, what they've been telling you. I know for many of us here, we were just so stunned at how swiftly it had to happen, that kind of life was normal. And then 10 minutes later, it wasn't.
That's right. You know, these high wind events are not unusual in Colorado winters, but we've had an extremely dry fall, summer and fall. And then when fire is introduced on a day when you have extremely high winds and it's introduced to the west of a large amount of urban homes, it's just a recipe for complete disaster. And you know, we've always thought about the possibility of this, but this was just everything coming together in a perfect awful way, where the fire was just bearing down, and 100 mile an hour winds, and they were sustained all day. And that explains why people had minutes to get out. And it is utterly amazing that we, it looks like we have two fatalities and we have some injuries, but how this was not a mass casualty event is truly a miracle.
Having spent a decade in post-Katrina New Orleans, you know, both your language here about, yes, I know we thought about it, but it took all of these factors coming together to make this horrible thing happen. I absolutely have empathy for that. But I also know that one of the first questions that often then emerges is, so should people have been living there, right? That was a question in the Lower Ninth Ward. It was a question in the East, and it's been a question in the context of post-Katrina recovery for two decades now. So let me ask that question. Given particularly the changing realities of global climate change, are these communities safe communities to live in?
Well, I think you've got many, many communities that are next to open spaces. And so I don't think this was really a factor of living, you know, in too close proximity to danger. In our neighboring city of Louisville, there are homes in the middle of suburban subdivisions that are burned to the ground. There's homes that are next to a golf course that are burned to a ground across a highway. So this was a firestorm that originated in open space. The cause is still being investigated, but it was a fire introduced, and it literally became a storm. So I don't really think this was a factor of homes being in too close proximity to a danger or an area that's prone to burn. I mean, any of our mountain communities in Colorado or throughout the world are perhaps more susceptible. So I don't think this was necessarily that case.
In many ways, Mayor, that answer makes perhaps post-fire policymaking even harder, right? If it was just so you could say, oh, you know, we can't live in these three districts, as painful as that might be, you know, it's a choice that could be made. But when you make this very clear point about how vulnerable really everyone is, so many communities are, how are you looking at the next moments and thinking about mitigation in a broader sense?
Yes, I'm already getting calls from people wanting to rebuild and wanting the town to move swiftly with cleanup and approvals of rebuilding. What I saw firsthand was there were homes that survived this, and they were in the absolute line of fire. And I want to know, and these were some newer homes and some older homes. So this was definitely a random, it was kind of random how it took out certain homes. But I think there are some building techniques, some building materials that can be employed to become or to help homes survive better. And there will be a future grass fire and in these open spaces. And the question is, can we make decisions now that will construct better homes so that they are a little bit more fire resistant? I don't think anything other than a concrete bunker is fireproof, but there are definitely things that can be done on homes to make them more fire resistant. And I want to, I don't want to drag our feet and not let people rebuild their homes, but I want to be smart about this, as because we've got that Sagamore subdivision you mentioned is 170 plus homes. Every single one of them is burned to the ground. So we're, you know, you get to kind of have a do-over on those, on that subdivision and several other parts of town. But we want to do it right, but we also want to make sure people can get back to their lives.
This could be framed as just an issue for you, for your community, maybe for that Sagamore subdivision. But I want to suggest, you know, part of the reason we put it in context with all these other things happening is that this could be any of us in any of our homes, depending on the kind of disaster. What kind of state and federal aid are you going to need?
We're going to need extensive aid, initially housing for people that have been displaced. We have a real housing crunch in Colorado now and in many parts of the country. And so it's going to be a challenge to get people housing. And then we're going to need help with the rebuilding effort and people that maybe have been uninsured or underinsured. And so it's going to take a great effort. And just appreciate you taking the time to reach out to me and cover this important story. I know we've got a lot of Colorado connections in your area and around the world. So appreciate the time to cover us.
Absolutely. Colorado is in the heart of the takeaway and of the nation right now. Mayor Clint Folsom is the mayor of Superior, Colorado. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The life-threatening winter challenges of these early days of 2022 echo the wintry brutality Texas endured last winter.
It's pretty cold inside. Last night, the temperature got down to about 37 degrees.
The power outages for millions spiraling into a health crisis.
Like, I've had dead people come in with higher temperatures than some of these patients.
I just got power on after 36 hours. I'm over it. We need some help.
Last February, Winter Storm Uri dumped snow, ice, and freezing temperatures across much of the southern U.S. In Texas, the conditions overloaded the state's power grid and left 10 million people without power for days on end. According to the Texas Department of State Health Services, 246 people died as a result of the storm and the freezing conditions that followed. And while Texas typically is spared the worst of winter, unpredictable patterns associated with global climate change have residents asking if the state's infrastructure is ready for the next storm. Phil Jankowski is a reporter covering politics and infrastructure at Dallas Morning News.
The United States is roughly divided into three large power grids, East, West, and Texas. That's how it's set up here. It's very individualized. There aren't that many interconnections between Texas and the rest of the country. And the reason for that, I'm sure you might be asking.
I'm thinking, why?
Yeah, the real reason for that is to avoid federal regulations, plain and simple. In special circumstances, the size of the state allowed it essentially to create a standalone power grid. And when Roosevelt created legislation that said that federal regulators would regulate interstate electric transmission, that's when Texas said, okay, we need to avoid that.
Now, why did they want to avoid it? Is it a cost issue? Is it about having that federal oversight? Is it just a Texas does it Texas's way?
A little bit of both. Texas does have a very strong history of being an independent state, going back to just the origins of the state itself. But throughout its history, the state has long been very wary of the federal government. dating back to Reconstruction. So you're just sort of seeing, you know, old wounds that can be traced all the way back to the Civil War playing out in infrastructure policy, as kind of bizarre as that is.
Now, when you talk about old wounds, let's talk about a more recent wound or pain, and that is the winter storm last year. Remind folks what Texas went through.
We went through what many, and especially those north of the Mason-Dixon line, would consider a bad cold snap. But down here in Texas, it was a natural disaster. It was basically about five and a half days of sustained temperatures across the state below freezing, decent amounts of snowfall in places that would never see that. The sustained amount of freezing temperatures led to power infrastructure to start failing. There was a double whammy of demand on the power grid going up because people were having to run their heaters 24 hours a day, which is just doesn't really happen often here. And then the big problem was that as that was happening, you were having at all stages of power infrastructure failures happening because of freezes.
Given that You've given us this sort of power grid east-west in Texas, and that the reason that Texas is standing alone has to do with, you know, in part, this sort of long history of a very particular relationship with the federal government. Are there internal sort of what we might think of as partisan politics within the state, right? So if Texas is on its own grid, oftentimes once there's no outside, you know, fight to be had with the federal government, then you start seeing the fights emerge internally. Is this, and I know it sounds odd, but is infrastructure in this sense, the Texas power grid, is it a partisan issue in the state?
Oh, absolutely. Like everywhere else. We're gearing up this year, not only for midterm elections, but also a whole slate of statewide elections. So notably, Beto O'Rourke is seeking to challenge Governor Greg Abbott, our governor, and has made the power grid one of his leading talking points, talking about how the power grid failed on Abbott's watch. And that's a reason for the failure of his leadership and why voters should be turning towards him this year as opposed to Abbott. And interestingly enough, we've got primaries coming up too. And so you're actually seeing Republicans that are running further to the right of Abbott, who's very conservative himself, that are also talking about the failures of the power grid. In response to that, Governor Abbott has made many assurances that the lights will stay on this winter, and has really kind of gone all in on that.
Obviously, the incumbent governor, Greg Abbott, has been extremely positive in his public narrative about this, saying that that everything is going to be fine and that the grid is able and ready to handle, you know, any stressors that are coming to it this winter. I'm wondering, you know, especially as you sort of have pointed to how important this issue is, how sort of very human it is in terms of how people experienced it. You know, sort of what you make of this positive language. Is it on the one hand just a good idea to keep the public from panicking, or is this setting up expectations that might not be able to be met?
If what happened in February 2021 happens again this winter, we're going to see widespread outages again. That's just a fact. Maybe it won't be quite as bad because of the weatherization of power plants, but the agency that runs the grid put out a report recently that basically said that there will be some outages. If Texas sees what it saw in an earlier event in 2011, that there would be outages across the state. And that's how they based their standards for that report. The February 2021 event was far worse. So you can only imagine, you know, what would happen. Well, actually, we don't have to imagine. We've already felt it if we see that again. So Abbott is saying one thing, but the agency that runs the grid, which is appointees of his, is saying another thing. So the grid most likely is not prepared for a repeat of what happened in 2021.
That was Phil Jankowski, a reporter covering politics and infrastructure at Dallas Morning News.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Now, in December, we brought you a rare bit of pandemic good news. Puerto Rico. After launching one of the most successful vaccination campaigns in the country, the island achieved a vaccination rate of 75%. But just a month later, the story is changing. Puerto Rico has reported a record 84,000 new cases in December. So what does that mean for Puerto Rico and for the pandemic in the rest of the country? Let's go to Donica Cotto, an Associated Press Caribbean correspondent based in Puerto Rico. Donica, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. This is going to sound like an odd question, but can we start with Bad Bunny?
Definitely. That's one of the biggest reasons why the island is seeing an uptick or a big explosion, really, in COVID-19 cases. So it was a 2-day concert. It was outdoors and more than 70,000 people attended total. So you have, you know, this huge crowd. They waited outside for hours before the concert started. And talking to concert goers, you know, many of them said they started off with masks on, but by the start of the concert or halfway through, you know, a lot of them had removed their masks. So officials say that more than 2,000 people who attended that concert tested positive afterward, but they're still tallying how many others they might have infected. But in addition to that concert, you also have holiday parties, family and friends visiting from abroad. And then you also had another, albeit smaller, much smaller, illegal outdoor concert held at a public housing project in late December as well, that featured artists, including Rosalía and Rauw Alejandro, with hundreds of people attending, you know, crowded in and not wearing masks.
Now, to be fair, though, those kinds of parties, whether they are the off the books kinds or whether they're, you know, the big concerts like Bad Bunny, I mean, over the course of this pandemic, they've happened in Chicago, in New York, in, you know, in Georgia. It does seem like it's maybe also the perfect storm of it happening during the Omicron and Delta variants, where you just had higher transmissibility.
Indeed. And the thing is, I mean, a lot of people were looking forward to the holidays here. I mean, the holidays here, as they say in Puerto Rico, start in Thanksgiving and don't end until the end of January. So you have, you know, 3 months worth of people celebrating, you know, starting with Thanksgiving, family visiting, all that. But the thing is that the island, you know, the institutions have become overwhelmed with positive cases, given the medical staff, the quarantines that they're in, and also the high number of medical professionals who have left the island in the past decade, largely because of the ongoing economic crisis. So in December alone, right now we're at a 36% positivity rate. In December, mid-December, that was 2%. So the number of daily cases per 100,000 rose from 3 to 224 in just 3 weeks.
And does the health department and health infrastructure on the island have the capacity to support these cases?
They're warning that they're nearing, you know, capacity. Right now in mid-December, there were about 30 people who were hospitalized. And now there are more than 500. But the other issue is also the amount of people trying to get tested. The health secretary gave a speech yesterday saying, we understand that there's a lot of fear, people trying to get tested, but they stress that if you have symptoms or if you know that you've been in contact with someone who has COVID-19, only then should you get tested. He noted that the island is doing an average of 40,000 tests a day. And he said that not even 15% of those tests are necessary. So this, you know, need to get tested has caused temporary shortages of home testing kits. You know, people are going on social media trying to figure out where they're still available. The Association of Hospitals has also urged people to stop visiting emergency rooms, saying that the demand is overwhelming. The reason the island is sort of nearing, you know, its capacity for trying to absorb all these new cases and hospitalizations resulted about more than a decade ago when the worldwide economic crisis began. And then coupled with that, in 2015, the island declared it couldn't pay its more than $70 billion public debt load. So right now, the island is actually in a bankruptcy-like process, trying to restructure its debt. And as well, you know, it's still trying to recover from Hurricane Maria, which hit in September 2017. So there's just been one hit after another. There was also a string of strong earthquakes about 2 years ago. So the island, you know, is trying to crawl out from all of this. And then, you know, the pandemic arrives. So we are receiving federal funds, but still, you know, there's just not enough staff to be able to handle not only people who are getting sick, but those who are seeking tests. For example, one pediatric hospital yesterday announced that it had reduced the number of beds available, given in part the exhaustion of medical staff. They just basically cannot keep up. And some people are standing in line starting at 2 a.m. trying to get tested. So the government is urging, you know, some restraint, telling people to only get tested if they have symptoms or if they've been exposed to someone who's been sick.
So as you're talking about the efforts of the island to move out of the economic crisis largely imposed by this kind of continuing sort of colonialist relationship of the mainland U.S. with Puerto Rico, and as you're kind of walking us through this, it's also true that Puerto Rico is a space where tourism matters a lot. And obviously, when you're looking at a pandemic, that has these critical effects. Can you say a little bit about what the government there on the island is doing relative to the question of tourism?
Indeed, that's been a very contentious point here on the island. I mean, tourism actually makes up not even 7% of Puerto Rico's GDP, but the government is trying to grow that sector. And cruise ships, you know, are a huge boost to the island's tourism sector. So the problem now is that the government announced recently that all cruise ship passengers who disembark must be fully vaccinated. And as well, they must provide a negative test taken 48 hours prior to arrival. So this recently caused at least 15 cruise ships to cancel their visits, and tourism operators said the cancellations have caused about some $20 million in losses. And coupled with that, you know, you have restaurants losing money, other operators losing money as well. Recent measures, given the increase in cases, include that businesses that sell food and drinks must reduce their indoor capacity to half and their outdoor capacity to 75%, at least until mid-January. The governor also has ordered restaurant employees and those who work in health and education sectors to receive their booster shots by mid-January. And that's the problem, although many have received the first or second dose, not even 40% have received a booster shot. So the health department is also focused. It's unclear. The health department is, you know, many are a little perplexed because, like you noted, you know, there's just such a high vaccination rate at the beginning. And now with the booster shot, you know, it's kind of lagging. So I think the health department is pushing for that. But again, there seems to be not as much enthusiasm, or at least people, you know, maybe in the holiday season, not remembering that, you know, they can get their booster shot now.
There hasn't, in your sense, though, been a decrease in trust around the booster shots, for example, compared to the vaccines?
I wouldn't say that there's been a decrease in trust. I just think people sort of, I don't know, maybe forgot a little bit, you know, that the pandemic existed, given that there was a 2% positivity rate at the time and they're preparing for the holiday season. And it just seemed like everything was kind of slowly going back to normal. But I think, you know, this recent spate might lead the island to possibly seeing a rise in people getting booster shots.
Yeah, COVID keeps doing that to all of us. Donica Cotto is a Caribbean correspondent for the Associated Press there in Puerto Rico. Thank you so much for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Death. The brutal COVID-19 pandemic, the ongoing opioid epidemic, and the frequent disasters prompted by global climate change have forced both personal and collective reckoning with death. As our elderly have passed on alone in hospital ICUs, and our young people have succumbed to lonely overdoses, many have wondered, what is a good death? And can my own death have meaning and value after I'm gone? In late December, Archbishop Desmond Tutu died at the age of 90 in Cape Town, South Africa. In life, he was a model of how to live. Teacher, theologian, activist, he championed the rights of the excluded and called for accountability from the powerful.
Our cause is a just cause, that we will attain human rights in South Africa and everywhere in the world.
Archbishop Tutu also left us a model of how to die. A longtime advocate of the environment, he requested that his body be aquamated. Aquamation uses water and a chemical called lye, rather than fire, to break down the body. It's touted as an eco-friendly alternative to traditional cremation because the process has fewer emissions and does not burn fossil fuel. Aquamation is part of a growing green burial movement that might allow individuals to extend their commitments to sustainability even after the final transition. In this country, one of the newest green alternatives to traditional burial is something called natural organic reduction, or human composting. The Takeaway's Meg Dalton has more on this.
10 years ago, Katrina Spade had an idea. She was 30 years old, an architecture student at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she began thinking more about her own mortality.
Partly because when you've turned 30, you know you are mortal. It suddenly hits you like a ton of bricks. And partly being in an architecture program just allowed me like the luxury of thinking about systems that humans create. And I got fascinated by the funeral industry as a system that we humans have created.
Spade's research revealed the troubling environmental impact of existing options.
So you've got conventional burial where you're manufacturing and transporting headstone, casket, and then you're upkeeping the cemetery. So lots of mowing and watering of that cemetery. And that carbon footprint is about equal to the carbon footprint of cremation, where you're using typically fossil gas to burn the body. And the other thing is cremation, of course, has emissions like mercury and particulates, and then of course carbon into the atmosphere.
And then there was green burial. That's when you bury a loved one with minimal environmental impact, in something like a pine box or a shroud. It's more feasible in suburban or rural areas where there's more cemetery space, but not exactly convenient for city dwellers like Katrina. Around this same time, Katrina got a phone call.
My friend Kate called me, and she asked if I'd heard of the practice by farmers of composting livestock. They compost whole cows. This has been happening for decades now, all over the US. And it was pretty much a light bulb. It's like, oh, well, if you can compost a cow, I'm certain you can compost a human being.
That was the beginning of Katrina's Seattle-based company, Recompose. It's the nation's first human composting facility. They've cared for more than 100 bodies since officially laying in their first human remains in December 2020. Inside the Recompose facility, there's a large white hexagonal structure. It looks a little like a honeycomb. It consists of 10 steel cylindrical 8x4 foot vessels in which the bodies are laid.
So the Recompose process is that each body gets placed into its own vessel. And this vessel is filled with a mixture of wood chips, alfalfa, and straw. So we kind of lay a bed of plant material inside of this vessel. And then we lay the person's body on top of that plant material and fill the vessel with more of the same. So in the end, you have what I sometimes think of as like a little hotel for the dead, just a little hotel room. You're lying cocooned inside a bunch of beautiful natural plant materials. And the vessel does a couple of things. One, it provides plenty of oxygen via a basic air system to the microbes that are doing the work, breaking down that plant material and the body itself. And also, periodically, we rotate that vessel very slowly so that all that's inside can get nice and aerated and mixed.
In the span of about 30 days, the body and plant material break down into a soil. It resembles compost you might buy at a plant nursery.
By law, you can spread that soil anywhere that you have permission from the landowner. And what we've seen is that families have chosen to use it on their home gardens. Some folks have grown a tree or three with that compost. We are creating about a cubic yard of soil per person who undergoes the recompose process. And it's like about a 3 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot box. If you can imagine, it's kind of a lot. And so we also have this option where families can donate the soil to conservation efforts. And we're finding about half of our families decide to donate the majority of the soil to conservation efforts.
According to Recompose, 1 metric ton of carbon dioxide is saved from entering the environment for every person who chooses human composting over burial or cremation. Human composting is also a lot cheaper. According to the National Funeral Directors Association, in the U.S., cremation costs an average of $7,000, while conventional burial averages $7,800. Recompose averages $5,500, and that includes everything from paperwork to the process itself. But natural organic reduction is still rare in the U.S. Just 3 states, Washington, Colorado, and Oregon, have legalized it. It's also been considered by a handful of other states, including California, New York, and Massachusetts. U.S. funeral and cemetery law is quite wonky. All forms of death care must be legal before the practice is offered in any state. That's part of the reason why the spread of natural organic reduction has been slow, according to Tanya Marsh. She's a professor of law at Wake Forest University and the host of the podcast Death et Sec.
In about half of the states, there is a statute that specifically limits the legally permissible methods of disposition of human remains. And so in those states, and they're starting with a baseline of we permit burial, cremation, donation to science, and removal from the state. Those are the 4 sort of baselines. So in those states, you can't either engage in alternate methods of disposing of human remains or offer for sale alternative methods of disposing of human remains. In the other approximately half of the states, we don't have a statute like that. However, there's no express legal framework that legally permits natural organic reduction. So then you're operating in a gray area. And I think that the funeral industry and the cemetery industry have come to the decision that they feel uncomfortable offering any new activities in that gray area without express permission from the state, because they don't want to make an investment in some new technology, new process, and then have the state come at them and say, oh, we decided we think this is actually illegal.
On top of those legal barriers, there's been some resistance to human composting in the U.S. First up, the Catholic Church. In states like New York, the Catholic lobby was instrumental in blocking legislation to legalize human composting.
We want to treat the human body with reverence and dignity. And the concern of the Catholic bishops here in New York and elsewhere is that really, composting human remains doesn't really fit into that definition of maintaining the dignity of the human body.
That's Dennis Paust, executive director of the New York State Catholic Conference. According to him, much of their resistance has to do with the Catholic belief in the resurrection of the body at the end of the world.
Human bodies, human corpses are not just like other inanimate objects. They're not just trash. So that's why we ritualistically have funerals and burials and funeral pyres in some traditions.
While the Vatican has not released instruction about composting, the Catholic Church does forbid the scattering of ashes, so it's unlikely to support the practice. Another group that opposes natural organic reduction might be more surprising, and that's funeral directors themselves.
Funeral directing is an extremely traditional business. That is a business. It's very much a business. And when you add a new type of disposition like human composting, it's a real threat to the traditional order of funeral homes and what they sell and how they sell it and how they deal with families and how they talk to families. And there's already enough things like green burial and even cremation that funeral directors find threatening. And for many of them, it just seems like natural organic reduction is a bridge too far.
That's Caitlin Doty, a mortician and self-described advocate for a better way to die. To be clear, Caitlin herself 100% supports natural organic reduction. To an extent, she understands why some people might be turned off by it, especially since it's still so new.
anything that we do that is new with the dead human body is going to get the media's, oh my gosh, the apocalypse is on us treatment. But when people actually learn what it is, I think the humanity of it and the interconnectedness of it and the kindness of it really shows through.
Despite opposition from the Catholic Church and some funeral directors, Caitlin says the launch of Recompose has been important for rethinking death care in America.
There's no question that we all feel this underlying existential terror about climate change and about the future of the planet. And there is something in the concept of human composting that takes us back to a place of acknowledgement that we are not higher level beings who should be able to control the world and pollute the environment. That we are humble creatures that are part of the natural cycle, just like any other creature. And it's important to meditate on that before we die. It's important to live with that knowledge, and it's important to die with those values.
Recompose is building a larger facility in their home base of Seattle, and also have plans to build out a facility in Denver, Colorado. Here's founder Katrina Spade again.
It really is about creating more choice around death care, giving as many options as possible. We're certainly not saying that human composting is for everyone. If you want to be cremated, you should have that option, I believe. If you want to have embalming and a big fancy casket, by all means, you should have that as well. But for those of us who are like trying to align, you know, our death care with our life experience and some of the values we hold dear, I think this is a really exciting option.
This is Meg Dalton for The Takeaway.
Now I want to touch on one final story before we go. On Tuesday, at least seven historically Black colleges and universities received bomb threats that disrupted work and life on those campuses when staff and students were asked to vacate buildings, at least temporarily. The list of targeted HBCUs made my blood run cold. Howard University in Washington, D.C. Xavier University in New Orleans. Norfolk State University in Virginia. Texas Southern and Prairie View A&M University in Texas. North Carolina Central University, just a couple hours up the road from my own home. Authorities have since issued all clear notices to the colleges, and the campuses are once again reopened after no bombs were found. And we're grateful and relieved that there were no acts of physical violence. But I just want to point out that these threats themselves, they recall a history of racist bombings in the U.S. South aimed at Black churches and schools. And it's a history we have revisited in recent days with the death of Maxine McNair. She was the last living parent of one of the four little girls killed in the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Mrs. McNair passed away at the age of 93. Let us not repeat the terrorism of our past. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. Tomorrow, we'll spend the hour marking the one-year anniversary of January 6th. So be sure to come on back. This is The Takeaway.